Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
ELRP payment eligibility requires livestock producers to have suffered grazing losses in a county rated by the U.S. Drought Monitor as having D2 for 8 consecutive weeks or D3 extreme drought or higher levels of drought intensity for either 2023 or 2024.
That's Farm Service Agency Administrator Bill Beam.
Were eligible for both years and have applied and been approved for LFP. Producers who permitted grazing on federally managed lands was reduced by wildfire are also eligible for ELRP if they applied and were approved for LFP in 2023 or 2024 or both calendar years again.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Senate Ag Committee grilling Ag Secretary Brooke Collins on Tuesday over delays in the $10 billion Emergency Commodity Assistance Program, ECAP, critical for farmers facing losses in 2024. Now, ECAP offers up to $250,000 per farmer with payments like $42.51 per acre for corn, but slow distribution has left producers scrambling ahead of the August 15th acreage report deadline. Senators, including John Bozeman, chairman of the Senate Ag Committee from Arkansas, pressed for faster aid to stabilize farm incomes, projected to drop to $139.1 billion for 2024. Farmers worried that without swift action, they'll struggle with rising input cost and tariff-driven export losses. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick faced tough questions at a Senate Commerce Committee hearing on Wednesday, where ag actually emerged as a key concern amid Trump's tariff policies. Lutnick highlighted the U.S.-India trade talks, aaming to cut India's 30 to 100% tariffs on almonds and cranberries, potentially boosting farmer exports by $5 billion. However, he admitted that China's 10% tariffs on U.S. soybeans and Canada's 25% tariffs on pork threatened $4.2 billion in farm exports, that's sparking fears of market losses. And Alaskan Senator Lisa Murkowski, who said Russia has declared war on the Alaskan seafood industry, asked the secretary to help define a path forward as the group looks for solutions. Congressional gridlock over the 2024 Farm Bill extension stalled by debates on SNAP cuts and conservation funding. Well, it continues to threaten U.S. farmers' access to crop insurance and commodity programs critical for 2025. Now, the chairman of the House and Senate Ag Committees, G.T. Thompson from Pennsylvania, and John Bozeman from Arkansas, face pressure to resolve disputes before the 2025 December deadline, as farmers fear disruptions to $139.1 billion in projected farm income. And looking at online posts from farmers, they highlight frustration, with many urging swift action to secure risk management tools. A Thursday phone call between Presidents Xi Jinping of China and Donald Trump from the U.S. sparked cautious optimism in U.S.-China trade talks, but farmers still remain wary as China's 10% tariffs on soybeans and 15% on wheat threatened $21 billion in exports. Trump claimed China would resume tremendous soybean purchases, yet no confirmed deals have emerged, echoing the promises of 2018 in that Phase 1 agreement. The talks ahead of a potential G20 meeting next month aim to ease trade tensions, but retaliatory tariffs continue to depress commodity prices. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
There are a few key words to really understanding when you're talking to your insurance person, and that is things like premium, indemnity, deductible, liability, and then eligible cause of loss.
Shannon Sand is a University of Nebraska at Lincoln Ag Economics Extension educator.
I'm not going to lie, there's a whole bunch more than this. And this website from RMA has a lovely list and a beginner's guide of insurance definitions. They have, I think it's two or three pages of them. So there's a lot. We're just going to go over these kind of five key ones we pulled out when we looked at, you know, insurance options for livestock producers specifically. So that was kind of what we came up with. But if you want additional information, RMA is a great resource. And again, this PowerPoint, I believe, will be available within the next, I want to say, 24 to 48 hours. So, and if you need that link, feel free to contact myself or Dr. Matt Stockton. Our email address was earlier and it will be later. But yeah, they have a lot of great information on additional resources and additional, again, key definitions. So premium is just that. It's what the policy costs you. So it's what you, and I say you, assuming that these are mostly producers on here, but it could be insurance agents, who knows. But what the producer actually pays to obtain the insurance product after the premium subsidy is deducted. So a premium subsidy, because we're talking about livestock and a format of crop insurance and risk management, planning. A premium subsidy is basically the portion of the premium that is paid by the government. So most crop formats of crop insurance, and I say crop insurance very loosely on here, fully understanding that my family have cattle. Okay. But the government classifies everything as a farm and everything as a crop, even cattle to some extent, sometimes depending on how broad their definition and who's doing it. But most formats of crop insurance, livestock insurance, things like that have a premium subsidy, which means a portion of that premium is paid by the government for livestock, forage, range, or again, crop insurance, depending on what we're looking at. Indemnity, right, is basically the payoff when the policy is actually triggered. So it's money paid to you when an eligible cause of loss results in what is considered by the policy. And again, that depends on what level of coverage you pick. Results in a sufficient loss. So the deductible is the amount of the expected livestock, forage, or crop value that is not covered by insurance. I think of it like car insurance a lot. So when you get in a car accident, hopefully that doesn't happen, but let's say you get into a fender bender and your taillight gets dinged. If you have a $1,000 deductible, that's what you have to pay to get your vehicle fixed. Say that the dent ended up costing $2,000 to repair was the estimate you received. You turn that into your insurance company. They're going to, well, hopefully, in theory, this is how it works, write you a check for $1,000. You have to cover that $1,000 that's missing. So that's your deductible. That's what you need to keep in your emergency savings. That's another reason that emergency savings, which we have videos on that, are really important to have. So that if, again, an emergency like that happens, you have stuff to, again, money to cover things in the bank. So eligible cause of loss, sometimes called coverage triggers, again, and if you ever go to an insurance agent and they're using all this jargon and you don't understand and they can't explain it to you, it might be time to look for somebody else. I'm just going to be honest with you.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
One of the things that I've been saying in this building for the last several months is this debate about what we call, I think somewhat wrongly and incorrectly, mandatory spending, because it's not mandatory. We've just chosen to put it on autopilot. It's automatic spending. It's not really mandatory.
Yeah, it's a better name.
Two conservative physical hawks on the floor of the House, Texas Representative Chip Roy, Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
The math has to math. The math has to add up. And is that, would the gentleman agree, the fundamental and core problem in this town when we're talking about the state of affairs? So, for example, we in this process have taken Medicare off the table politically. The president has asked us to take Medicare off the table. We have taken Social Security off the table because by law, we are not allowed to touch Social Security in the reconciliation process. And then interest is off the table because you got to pay it. You can't just magically not pay the interest. So that adds up to what? about 47% of the total frigging budget, half the budget.
And just understand, in reconciliation, which is the one time we're allowed to talk about mandatory spending, the majority of mandatory spending we're not allowed to touch.
Correct.
Because if you use Social Security and interest, that's probably 54-55% of all mandatory. Sorry, it's a weird way I remember numbers. So let's actually, let's risk our political careers. How many of you have read the Wall Street Journal articles from the last year? I think they've done five or six major exposés on something we call Medicare Part C. It's the Medicare Advantage. It was the sort of managed care version within Medicare option that was developed by Republicans in 2005. One of their articles basically says they identified about $63 billion of waste, fraud, misalignment a year.
Right.
A year.
Right.
A year. Yeah. The MedPAC report, because I'm the only idiot who came here to the floor with the MedPAC, but it's partially my responsibility being Ways and Means. The MedPAC report all highlighted, and we showed the MedPAC report says Medicare Advantage, the Part C, is coming in at 120% of fee-for-service. Just that delta from where it was supposed to be at 95%, I know there's a lot of numbers, when we designed Medicare Advantage, long before you and I got here, it was supposed to come at 95% of fee-for-service. That 25% delta is $100 billion a year. And if you do the curve, because of the growth of the program it's expected, that's $1.5 trillion over 10 years, just putting it back to what it was supposed to be. It's equal to everything we're talking about trying to reform in our reconciliation packages. How many conversations have we been willing to have saying, hey, you do realize we could modernize Medicare Advantage so the incentive for the providers is to have populations be healthier than running around and scoring them as sicker. Just align the incentives. I just found $2 trillion. Why can't we have conversations like this where we're trying to preserve the programs and the future at the same time? The moment you answer, there will be an army of paid lobbyists, people running ads in your district, probably now beating the crap out of me on social media.
Yeah.
Because when it's that sort of money, you know they're going to. And you also saw the articles 3 weeks ago, Wall Street Journal. There's criminal investigations now going on. Justice Department now is diving into these folks. So there's more going on here. I will argue, Mr. Roy, and some of our friends who are fiscal conservatives but also want to modernize the delivery of services, help me. We have spent almost a year diving into the data. What would happen if fixing these misalignments, the waste and fraud, actually it doesn't get us where we need to be, but it starts moving us the right direction?
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I would say it is the premier event in the U.S. when it comes to the pork industry.
Minnesota pork producer and immediate past president for the National Pork Producers Council, Lori Stevemeyer, talking about a two-day event held in Des Moines, World Pork Expo.
And actually, all the world. We have individuals from over 30 countries here, and it is all things pork. So we have educational seminars, we have a trade show with all the latest technology and equipment, and we have hospitality tents that line Grand Avenue where you can go out and eat great pork, sit and network with your neighbors, and just celebrate everything that's good about the pork industry.
World Pork Expo is organized every year by the National Pork Producers Council.
Sure, we are voluntarily funded trade association. So we focus on public policy, regulatory, and exports. And so we are really working on farmers' behalf in Washington, D.C. We work in partnership with some of our states and then also international. So like I said, we're voluntarily funded, and we certainly appreciate that support from our producers to go ahead and engage on those key issues.
Prices here in 2025 for pork producers have been good, but there are other challenges and opportunities.
Well, when I look at challenges, I would say one that I've been, you know, working on really my whole time on the board is the California Prop 12. And for those that aren't familiar with that, it's a California ballot initiative that's basically telling the rest of the nation how to produce pork if they want to sell within California. And so we've been working real hard and focused on the Farm Bill for a federal solution, federal preemption to Prop 12. And why that's important to our farmers is because if California makes rules one way and other states make rules different way, we have what we call this patchwork of regulations. And that makes it hard for us to make business decisions and changes if we're always dealing with something that's changing in a patchwork. I would say another challenge we look at, and we alluded to it a little bit, was trade and exports. And we certainly want to make sure that those are still available. We are always concerned about health and implementing a good biosecurity practices against health challenges, whether that's foreign diseases like African swine fever or domestic diseases. Maybe a challenge that people aren't aware of is the MAHA report that came out. And while the benefit is that it recognized protein and the value of protein, there are also some language in there that is concerning relative to modern agriculture and some of the farming practices we have. So I would say those are the challenges on our market or on our radar. When I look at the opportunities and the positive, I mean, why do we get up each day and do what we do? I will go back to the fact that pork is a wholesome, nutritious, affordable protein. And you know that there's a big focus on protein now in our country, which is good. And so pork fits in there as families are trying to feed their families on a budget. Pork fits in there. I think we also have to remember the role of our farms and communities. Our farms hire people. Those people are part of the community. They go to churches. They are part of fire departments. They're volunteers. And our farms are really a key aspect of our rural communities. And so that's really important as we've seen some of those populations shrink. So that's the benefit of being a farmer. And that's really what makes me proud to be a farmer. I'm producing a food for the nation, and I'm part of my community.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We've also talked about how integrated the Maine economy is with Canada.
At a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee hearing, Maine's Susan Collins with Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick.
Canada's our closest neighbor, our dear friend, and our largest trading partner. And so I have been very concerned, and I know the department and you personally are working very hard on this issue about tariffs on Canadian products. Our lobster, our potatoes, our blueberries are largely processed in Canada and then come back across the border. We have a paper mill in northern Maine, in Madawaska, Maine, whose sister mill is right across the river in Canada. The sister mill in Canada produces the pulp that is piped across the river to the paper mill in Madawaska, Maine. So that's how close the partnership is. 95,000 Mainers are not connected to the New England electric grid. They get their electricity from Canada. I just mentioned these examples. 95% of our refined petroleum products come from Canada. 90% of potash, which is used the fertilizer for potatoes, comes from Canada. Just to give you a few examples of how integrated our approach is, could you give me a brief update on where we stand with Canadian tariffs?
Sure. So the overriding principle is USMCA. So if the products are actually made in Canada and actually made in the United States, they come back and forth, and it's easy for them to fall under the USMCA, and that has no tariff. No tariff. Things that are outside of that, where companies chose to be outside of those rules, and those rules, as you know, have been in place quite a long time. If they're outside of those rules, then they have a tariff on them. They have the fentanyl tariffs, right? Because we needed to close the border and make sure fentanyl was not coming into the country. And people say, oh, Canada doesn't do much in fentanyl. But if you look at the fentanyl rings in Canada, they're often manned by Mexican cartels. So we needed to shut that. And so those outside of USMCA do pay a tariff, but those inside of USMCA are free of tariff.
Thank you. If you would provide us with a list of which products are under USMCA, that would be very helpful to us. I believe that a lot of the cases that I've mentioned will be under the USMCA.
Correct.
And thus exempt from the tariff. But it would be good to have some certainty in that area. So if we could work with you and your staff to try to get a more definitive list, that would be very
sure helpful. That primarily comes from USTR, but I will call them and I will have it to you.
And Kansas Senator Jerry Moran.
Would you commit to me that you'll be helpful to that cause in making sure that we don't damage agricultural exports while we take the steps necessary to, over hopefully a short period of time, move our country in the direction of manufacturing ships in the again?
Be my pleasure.
Thank you.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So pasture, rangeland, and forage insurance, it is used to basically safeguard producers against forage losses caused by lower than average rainfall.
Shannon Sand is a University of Nebraska at Lincoln Ag Economics Extension educator.
So it's a rainfall index based program. So basically it pays ranchers when precipitation in a specific time period and grid area. So FYI, that grid could be the whole county, could be a whole region. It could be, depending on how it's set up, a lot of areas. So if that area falls below average, it could be triggered. It's designed to offset basically additional feed costs or losses due to drought or poor forage coverage. And that coverage is based off of NOAA, that National Oceanic Atmospheric Association, whatever they are called. It's based off of NOAA, N-O-A-A rainfall data, and not individual pasture performance. Again, so it's based off of a pretty good size region and area most of the time. In this example, Emma runs a cow-calf ranching operation with 1,000 acres of native rangeland in Custer County, Nebraska. Her grazing season runs primarily from May through September. And again, this is all made up. And she depends heavily on seasonal rainfall to sustain her pastures. So to protect her operation from below average rainfall, which would reduce forage availability and potentially force her to buy supplemental feed or hay or some other sort of product or reduce her herd size, she purchases PRF insurance. So this is Emma's setup. So again, location, Custer County, Nebraska, total acres, 1,000. Coverage level is 90%. Productivity factor is 100%. We're saying all the forage is available and there's full forage value. So our insured months, because with PRF, you have to pick the months you're insured, are May to June and July to August, which is peak grazing season. So the county-based value is $22 an acre. So our total insured value is $22 an acre times 1,000 acres. Plus we pick two intervals, May, June, July, August. So $44,000 is our total insured value. So Emma's located in Custer County, Nebraska. She's got 1,000 acres insured. Her coverage level is 90%. Productivity factor, again, she's saying she's got 100% full forage value. Her insured months are May and June, and then July, August. She picked peak grazing season for that area. And then, like I said, that $22 an acre times 1,000 acres. Again, we picked those two intervals. So we have $44,000 in coverage, but it's only over those two intervals. Remember that. So the subsidy rate is 51% for 90% coverage. So the gross premium before any sort of premium subsidy is $44,000. So the net premium that Emma actually pays is $2,156 in this case. So that's what she had to pay to insure her forage. In this first scenario, we look at this and we see that Emma had a drought, or that there was a drought in Custer County in May and June. And rainfall is 30% below average in the grid, right? So it's based on grids. So again, you'll want to work with your insurance agent on a lot of this. The NOAA index triggers a payment of $9,000. So because it's 30% below, and based on all of that, there's calculations that go into it, it's going to trigger a payment of $9,000. Emma's going to use this payout, hopefully, to purchase some hay and reduce financial pressure on her operation. So again, that's just one way to use PRF.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Mostly good news as we get a little deeper into the 2025 growing season.
Regarding the latest U.S. drought monitor and crops and commodities in drought, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says for the period ending June 3rd,
corn and soybeans in drought, those numbers are much better than what we've been seeing prior to planting. And as we get into the growing season here,
cotton area is also in low drought coverage, a big month-over-month decrease, according to Rippey.
In terms of our spring wheat crop, we had some disappointingly low conditions as we started the 2025 growing season there, but hopefully you'll be able to take advantage of some of the improved moisture in the last couple of weeks.
Winter wheat in drought has also been halved from the previous month.
U.S. hay production area in drought, just 19%. That is down from 28% at the end of April. U.S. cattle inventory in drought, just 21% in drought on June 3rd. That is down from 31% on April 29th.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.